Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us. We are now joined in studio by Attorney General Doug Gansler, Democratic candidate for governor of the state of Maryland, and Delegate Julian Ivey, who represents the 47th District in Prince George's County, who's running with Doug Gansler to be Lieutenant Governor of the state of Maryland. And Julian Ivey and Doug Gansler, welcome. Good to have you both in the studio.
It's good
to be
here.
Mark. Thanks.
You can all join us here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. We're going to be talking with every candidate at least once, if not more, between now and June to give you all the chance to hear what they have to say for the major offices that we are facing in the state of Maryland. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. I've got to pick up my phone that fell on the floor, but I'll get it. You can also just log on to our Facebook pages. But 410-319-8888 is the number to call to talk with Doug Gansler and Jolie Ivey. And welcome to WEA. Good to have you both with us.
Glad to be here.
You were here last night.
I think so, something like that.
I was here really last night. I was over at Tove Pizza in Pikesville. It was the end of Passover, and they have this big thing where everyone can start eating pizza again. So I was there greeting pizza goers.
Did you eat pizza?
I did, and I brought my mother with me, too. So we had a good time. I got home about 1, and back at Morgan State, it doesn't get better.
You know, Abramoff worked there. Did you know about that?
I did not know that.
Yes, when he got out of prison, they gave him a job. 410-319-8888. We'll take some calls here in just a moment. Let's start off with the latest controversy, Doug.
Is there a controversy?
Yes, there is.
Welcome to politics.
It is politics. Politics, as Bob Marley
exactly.
would say.
Exactly.
But it is something that people are talking about ever since you made the comments about the lieutenant governor.
Yeah, his leadership on health care.
That wasn't the comment you made. You made a comment about where is his real leadership coming from? I mean, is he making a kind of a aspersions to that being in the military really wasn't that important, that it wasn't really and people got really upset about what you said the other night.
Well, he got upset, yeah.
And a lot of people got upset. I mean, the question is, I can read the quote to you, but you know your own quote, which we can pull up. But the question is, During this campaign, it seems like we are. I mean, this has happened a lot to you during the campaign. Just words coming out, and people kind of going after you because of the way you put things, and that we've seen between you and Brown, and Mazier seems to be out of this fray in the sense of not joining this kind of fight. But it just seems like backbiting, back and forth, fighting. Throwing slurs. When are we going to talk about something more serious?
And it's ugly because people really want to talk about the issues. And particularly in Baltimore, which has so much potential, and it's a city that has so much room for growth in terms of, you know, bridging the minority achievement gap, getting jobs into Baltimore, providing health care access, which is what these comments were about. I haven't really said anything inappropriate that I'm aware of in a long time. Probably to my kids once in a while, maybe, but that's usually inside the house. But the you're right. I mean, people really want to vote on the issues, and they want to hear what the candidates have to say, and they don't want to take this sort of, as you call it, political tricks where. Politics, I guess, where they take words, mix them up, and pretend you said something you didn't say or even come close to saying.
Well, I'm not going to spend the whole hour on this because it's too many more important things to talk about in terms of the race itself. But I get, you know, when you said, you know, his campaign ads are about how he was a lawyer in Iraq and all that's fine and good, but this is a real job, and we need to have somebody who actually has leadership experience. Many people took that as an aspersion on his time in Iraq, veterans kind of.
Well, you know what? My dad, Mark, was a Buffalo soldier. I mean, he was in World War II. He was in the Korean War. He had 2 Bronze Stars, 2 Purple Hearts, which he says no one wanted, and a Silver Star as well. He saved people's lives in the line of duty. And I have so much respect for veterans and for all that they've done for our country. And there is absolutely no way I would be on the ticket with Doug Gansler if I didn't know for a fact that he felt the same way. So the real issue here is that Anthony Brown has failed our state. When it comes to the health care rollout, it's been a disaster. And he's just trying to distract people from that fact. So if we can stick to the facts, I think we'll end up with the right governor and the best person to lead our state.
And that was what the comments were. The question was at a tech conference, and the question was exactly about the healthcare rollout. And so the comments were precisely that. Nobody was saying anything disparaging about veterans. We love, you know, obviously we respect and revere our veterans. We need to do a lot more for our veterans, frankly, here in the state of Maryland. I was being disparaging about is his civilian leadership here in Maryland and the lack of of ability for people to get health care. You know, this is the one thing he's ever been put in charge of that, by his own admission. You know, this is his deal, and he was supposed to do the enrollment for the Affordable Care Act. Now, as you know, I ran President Obama's campaign in Maryland along with Elijah Cummings. I went to the Supreme Court of the United States to defend the Affordable Care Act on the constitutionality of it. We're the only country in the civilized world that did not provide access to health care for all its citizens. So the Affordable Care Act is an incredibly important thing to have for all of us. But in Maryland, we're behind Mississippi. And we were 47th. We had probably fewer than 1,000 people were actually able to enroll on the website, yet we've spent over $200 million of taxpayer money trying to do so. And so, you know, and then the cover-up is sort of worse. No, we don't know what happened to that $200 million because—
A cover-up?
Well, it's the cover-up. I mean, look, the special interest, the status quo, the machine that is all behind the lieutenant governor in trying to perpetuate 8 more years of the O'Malley-Brown leadership won't have hearings or won't get to the bottom of what happened to this $200 million of taxpayer money. And, you know, the people that lose are the people that can't get chemotherapy or heart transplants or access to health care for their children, not to mention the taxpayer money, but the even sort of the future problem is when the enrollment period opens again on November 15th, you know, if we don't see what happened, what the failures were in the past, how are we going to fix it in the future? So, yeah, I mean, you can call it what you want. And, you know, maybe I'm calling a cover up and there'll be another 2 days of stories on that. But I don't see any other way of looking at it. You know, it's $200 million of taxpayer money and we can't get people access to health care. I don't know what else to describe it as.
And in addition to that, if you think about it, this isn't just about this one case. This isn't about just the health care rollout and its failure. It's about what kind of leader do we want for the state of Maryland. So we already know what kind of leader Anthony Brown is or isn't. We already know that he tried to take credit for the health care rollout until it started going south, and then he tried to distance himself. And now he's trying to change around and say it was a success. So since he can't get away from the fact that he is the leader of it, and it was horrible, so instead he's trying to define it as a success, which we all know is laughable at best and offensive, and really. So what are we going to have next? You know, the state has a lot of serious issues facing us every day, and we can't have somebody in charge who avoids responsibility when things aren't going well and pushes it off on other people and tries to blame someone else when he's the one who's in charge and he's the one who failed.
What we'll do here is a lot of people are calling in to talk to the two of you.
You've got a lot of friends.
We have a lot
of listeners. It's good to be you.
And
yeah.
Some friends. And a lot of people calling in to talk with you, and we'll be writing in, I'm sure, as well. We have one email here I'm going to read that came in already. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So what I'll do is bring you all onto the phone. I'll have you ask a question. I'll ask a question. You ask a question. I'll ask a question. How's that sound? So we all get a chance to talk to Doug Ansler and Jolene Ivey. 410-319-8888. And Joe, you're on the air.
Hi.
Good morning, Joe.
Excuse me. I saw that you responded to the criticism about your remarks, but you have refused to apologize. Will you apologize to veterans? And if not, why do you feel that you shouldn't?
Well, it's always good to have a Brown supporter call, but I don't feel like I should apologize to veterans because, you know, my father was the Undersecretary of Defense of the United States. We went to the Supreme Court on the Westboro Baptist case to protect the insidious conduct that was directed toward military families in the country. And, you know, we need to actually support our veterans here in Maryland. We need to make sure we have the worst veterans administration in Baltimore in the country in terms of getting people their relief that they're entitled to. We need to worry about post-traumatic stress disorder. We need to look at veterans courts. There's so much more we can do for our veterans as more and more of people who serve our country with dignity and respect come back to our country and don't get that same dignity and respect. So, you know, I said nothing disparaging about veterans. I don't feel anything disparaging about veterans. I think I admire our veterans. And I admire the lieutenant governor's service as a lawyer in Iraq. And I wouldn't say anything to the contrary. What we were talking about yesterday at a technology forum, was in response to a question about his leadership on the Affordable Care Act. And we were talking about his leadership and his failed leadership in the state of Maryland. And as I was driving through Baltimore this morning, I was thinking about, well, how terrible would it be if we actually didn't win? If he was going to be the governor for the next 8 years, how bad would his schools be? The public schools in Baltimore, they literally say, we've got the number one schools in the country. Yet the reality is we have the number two minority achievement gap in the country. So if I say to people in Baltimore City all the time, and I work here and I'm here, I'm the Baltimore candidate in the race, I say, listen, if you think your child is at the number one school in the public school system here in Baltimore City, if you're in the number one school in the country, you should vote for the lieutenant governor and get your friends to. But if you want change, if you want to bring somebody in that cares about Baltimore and its problems, you should vote for the Gansler Ivy team.
So let me follow up on that, what you just said. So what would you do any different? I mean, people talk about education in every race. So what would be so different about a joint Ivy administration in terms of what you would do? And if you can tell me more money, where's it going to come from? I mean, what would you do that's any different than they're doing?
Yeah, I don't think the solution is money. Obviously, the wonderful thing is Jolene Ivy and people in the General Assembly and the Baltimore delegation got $1 billion into school funding. And we need to make sure we get the second phase of that funding as well. Because, you know, where you go to school matters. But what's inside the school matters more. And so, you know, I was the first gubernatorial candidate and first statewide candidate to come out for increasing pre-K from half day to full day. That was what they were supposed to do with the money when they went from slot machines to table machines. They took it out at the end and said, oh, never mind. And so, you know, I think every child in Maryland should have access to full day pre-K. I want to start that, though, by focusing on the families that are 300% above the poverty line and below so that we can really work to make sure the underserved communities have that, because one of the major reasons why we have a minority achievement gap is when children show up in kindergarten from underserved communities, they have a 300-word vocabulary. When they come from Howard County or some other places in the state, they have an 8,000 to 10,000-word vocabulary. We need to bridge that gap. Then on the back end, you have to stay in school until you're 18 years old. What we want to do is when you're 16, if you don't want to continue a traditional path and you want to get a job, for example, you want to be an electrician, you do your math and your English in the morning. In the afternoon, you do a career vocational apprenticeship where you actually go and work for an electrician, because it takes 10,000 hours to get accredited in Maryland. So when you graduate and finish school at 18 years old, now you have a certification and as well as a diploma, so you can start work on Monday. And finally, we want to make sure we have skilled teachers. Like any other profession, any other place in the world, you reward and pay more to the great teachers that we have. You can go in any school and say, who are the good teachers, who are the bad teachers? And you'll get the same answers from the teachers and the kids. And we got to make sure the bad teachers aren't teaching our kids anymore.
And you know, I think one of the most exciting parts of our education plan is, you know, most children, when they're learning, most of their learning happens at home and long before they get to even pre-K. If we don't do more to help the children who are struggling the most from the time before they're born until the time they start pre-K, they actually are starting so far behind. So one thing we want to do is have an expansion of the home visiting program, which right now just uses social workers to go into the homes of low-income, at-risk teen moms. This is a wonderful program, and it's very effective, but it's limited right now because it's only a small program that helps people using the social workers. But if we expand the program and use people who are student teachers, people who are in the faith community who want to volunteer, we could reach so many more of these moms and these children. And the way it works is a person goes into the home, helps the teen mom from the time she's pregnant, make sure she makes it to her prenatal appointments, make sure the baby gets all the vaccinations on time, and really, very importantly, make sure that that mother learns how to read to her child, how to speak with her child, so that when that child gets to pre-K, is on level with the other children of their age. Otherwise, those 300-word vocabulary, it's not going to make it to the thousands and thousands of words they're going to need by the time they get to kindergarten.
Let me, again, as I promised, go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Christina in Bowie, Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi,
Christina.
Hi, I've been listening to all the news in the past couple of days, and I was just wondering if you consider your tenure as state's governor to be a real job.
I'm sorry, my tenure state's governor. I'm not the governor yet, but I promise you, end of our gubernatorial stint, the changes that are necessary in Maryland in terms of bringing jobs back and bringing the minority achievement gap, getting transportation, public safety, and the environment, I think we'll certainly consider that to be a real job.
So I want to ask you this question, then we go back to our calls. We have John and Mike and Bruce and others. So call 410-319-8888. Come to your calls. But this is a question I think that everybody doesn't want to tackle. The state legislature doesn't want to tackle it. They won't tackle it. The governor's office hasn't tackled it. And I'm curious how – I'm going to ask every person who walks to his office who's in the studio who's going to run for this office to answer this question. We have a ticking time bomb in Maryland. It's called the systemic debt that we face in the state budget. Nobody wants to address this. We'd rather kind of dip into funds to figure out how to pay and close the gaps. But we have pension issues coming up. Every state in the country is dealing with state deficits that are looming. They're not going away, but nobody wants to figure out how to put their hands around this huge issue. What will the two of you be bringing to the state when it comes to that?
Well, and actually potentially it could become worse because what the Brown O'Malley administration did was they took another $100 million out of the pension fund, which is actually going to jeopardize our AAA bond rating, which could jeopardize our situation even further. And to your point, what they do is, for example, the Transportation Trust Fund, they violate the people of Maryland's trust, literally, by taking all that money out of the Transportation Trust Fund, using it for other things, and saying, oh, my God, we have no money left in the Transportation Trust Fund. Let's do our 40th tax in a row and tax poor people and working people by having this gas tax. So, you know, I think the current trajectory for the Brown O'Malley administration, what they want to do, and the lieutenant governor's running to be Martin O'Malley for another 8 years, is to have our economic future viability be based on and predicated upon more casino gambling and more taxes. And so if you look across the river, for example, in Virginia, they don't have this systemic debt. In fact, they have $1 billion in a rainy day fund because they promote job growth. And that's the biggest problem, I think, facing our state right now. Baltimore City, of the adult males, 46% are out of work. And so you have a problem where all our businesses are leaving. We've lost over 7,000 small businesses in the last 8 years. 76% more people are unemployed than they were 8 years ago. And we have four Fortune 500 companies. Out of the 500, only four left. And each day it gets worse. We just heard we're going to might lose McCormick. And so the reason why that matters is if you don't have jobs, your tax base continues to dwindle. And you don't have a tax base, you don't have the money to afford all the things that we, at least the two of us who are Democrats, want to see. I don't know what you are, of course. I wouldn't venture to guess what party you might be.
And I'm not going to tell you.
Of course.
But it's all public.
You look like a rabid Tea Party guy to me. Yeah,
that's me.
Yeah.
That's me. So I think we have 15 seconds of break. So I'm going to come back and ask another question, follow up with that. Then we'll write back to the phones at 410-319-8888. We have a lot of issues to tackle here. So stay with us as we talk with Doug Ansler and Julian Ivey, who are running to be the next governor and lieutenant governor, respectively, of the state of Maryland. Welcome back. We're here with Attorney General Doug Ansler, who is running to become the next governor of the state of Maryland, Delegate Julian Ivey from Prince George's County, who is running to be the next lieutenant governor of Maryland. Did I say Baltimore? Maryland? 410-319-8888.
Same thing.
It's close. 410-319-8888.
I did go to Towson.
You went to Towson?
Yeah, I did.
410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Mike, we're going to come to your call next, but I want to follow up with what I was saying earlier and get to Mike and then let's read this email. And I guess, you know, when I was listening to what you were saying, Doug, my question was, Julie, maybe you can start with this. I mean, so then what sets your economic policies different from a Republican's when you're talking about cutting taxes for corporate America and that's the way to go about it? Some people would go, what's the difference between that and a Republican a manifesto about what we should do for the economy of the state of Maryland?
I don't think that defining anything as one thing or the other makes sense. We're about closing corporate loopholes, which you might say is a Democratic value. And we want to make sure that people are paying their fair share, but that it doesn't get to the point where we're killing business. We want to make sure that people can have jobs. And I think, isn't that a Democratic value, that people can work?
Well, and just to, if you're going to be labeling that, I mean, Barack Obama, Steny Hoyer, Chris Van Hollen, all good Democrats are all for reducing the corporate tax and have been for some time. And the reason why, the motivation, of course, is none of, well, maybe they do. I certainly don't own a company. And so the motivation, obviously, is to attract businesses here. The reason why you want to attract business is here is to have people get jobs, you know, green money. You know, this isn't a blue thing or a red thing. It's a green thing. And if we have people have jobs, they're not unemployed, and there's a lot more opportunity opportunity for folks to raise their families and do great things in this incredibly wonderful state. I'm the only candidate for governor in the race that grew up in Maryland, and I love the state, and I want to see it flourish, not continue on the downward spiral that it is, at least in the economic sense, you know, being 43rd in the country in manufacturing, being 40th in tech transfer in terms of ideas that are conceived here and then produced elsewhere. And so we have a lot of real issues that we need to tackle on the economic side.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join in this conversation with Doug Anza and Jolene Ivey. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I have an email here to read, but let's go to Mike first in Baltimore City. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm a veteran of Iraq. I served from 2009 to 2010, and I had a question for you. Kind of a backstory. Today's wars are so different than the ones in the past, where you could be there's no front lines, that you could be anywhere from the cook to the supply clerk to the lawyer to the infantryman that actually goes out. We all sleep in the same base. That same base is getting pounded by mortar fire, rocket fire, every single night. So it's very dangerous no matter what your job, and it takes an inordinate amount of strength and courage to do that, as well as to be able to maintain your cool under stress and perform your duty and your job. So with that, my question is, do you think somebody that does that as a career, the military for 30 years, regardless of your job, and they've never held another job, all they have is the military for that 30 years, that was their career, do you think that person would be qualified for governor?
Yeah, person, certainly that's a credential to be a governor. I mean, I think serving your country and your loyalty to your country and, frankly, public service in that regard at the deepest and highest level is certainly something that would qualify somebody to be governor. The question that I was answering was regarding leadership and civilian leadership and about the one thing that look, we all know the lieutenant governor did absolutely nothing for 6 or 7 years until he started running for governor, and then he showed up a few places. The two things that he was in charge of, one he doesn't really talk about either, was the implementation of BRAC, which was an unmitigated disaster in terms of infrastructure being built, roads, jobs, and opportunities. So everyone that came here for BRAC is now going back to the states they came from, and we haven't really benefited economically from that at all. And then the second was the Affordable Care Act rollout, which is, you know, the signature initiative of our president, the president whose campaign I ran. And it's a critical – to be able to have access to health care is a critical – if you don't have health care, you don't need to discuss all the other stuff that we talk about. And so the fact that he, like, proud as a peacock, ran around saying, I'm in charge. Don't worry about it. Maryland's going to be fine because Anthony Brown's in charge. And then and he's still on his website. I mean, he's still out there. As recently as last week, he was saying to the press, this has been a huge success. When, as far as we can tell, fewer than 1,000 people in the hundreds were actually able to enroll over the website, which is what he was in charge of. And so it gives the Republicans an opportunity to bash our president and bash the very concept of providing health care to all people in Maryland under the Affordable Care Act. They're bashing that when the reality was the failed leadership in terms of what happened to that $200 million-plus dollars and why won't you tell us what happened and what was your role in that? And we need to make sure we fix that. And I called for going to the federal system months ago because the federal system works. And not just the federal ability to enroll through the federal website into the Maryland Exchange. And they didn't want to do that, just like they didn't want to put an independent investigation into what happened at the jails and why they continue to have mass arrest in Baltimore. So we've got some problems. We're looking forward to changing those problems.
So go back to the phone in just a moment. Many people are calling in. I mean, do you really – the one thing you just said there, again, this is the kind of stuff I have to only raise because – of the way things are said. Do you really think that, whether you believe that Governor Brown, Lieutenant Governor Brown should be governor or not be governor, that he did nothing for 6 or 7 years? You just said that.
Well, I think he, you know, in terms of leadership, and that's what the question was about, you know, I think he showed up some places. I saw him once in a while. I mean, I was the head of the governor's Family Violence Council and remained chair of that for 8 years, and he never showed up. He showed up once for 10 minutes. He was on there. He actually did not want to be the co-chair of that particular committee, and then you know, his run around saying he did something to help promote domestic violence laws in the state, and we know that didn't really happen. And so, you know, most people hadn't seen him. I'm sure you hadn't, you know, most people hadn't seen him for 6 or 7 years until he started running for governor. I don't know that that's really saying much, but it certainly doesn't go to leadership qualities and leadership skills. If you're going to be a leader, you have to lead. And so, you know, HBCUs. We're sitting in an HBCU right now, woefully adequately, inadequately funded. It still takes 14 years to build a school in an HBCU, a building in an HBCU, and it takes the same for that same building to be built at a white school. It takes 6 years. Nobody's, you know, he's been sitting there while that's happening and hasn't done anything about it. The minority achievement gap continues to explode. The economy, we have a $1 billion deficit each year as they go to Annapolis, hasn't done anything on that. So we have some, transportation. We have the most crowded roads in I'm almost late for the show. You know, we have the most congested streets in the country here. And, we haven't had a high-speed rail from Baltimore to Washington. So there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed, and they haven't really been addressed in the last 6 or 7 years.
I have a high-speed rail question for you, because you came out the other day. I want to ask you a question about that. But let me read this email first that came in from a listener. He said, Doug Ganser and his office have vigorously and steadfastly opposed counsel for poor people when they first appear before a judicial officer. During the past 7 years, his attorneys have relentlessly opposed the right to a lawyer when their liberty is at first at stake. Between 2007 and 2012, the Attorney General's office argued against a lawyer at bail review hearing 2, leaving most Maryland low-income people without counsel for 30 days or more after arrest. Then, since last September's landmark constitutional ruling, Ganser has opposed immediate implementation at every turn. Since African Americans comprise such a high proportion of people arrested, why has he not championed for this fundamental right that provides equal justice for the poor as well as for people who can afford for private counsel?
Well, there's a couple things. One is the decision. There is no fundamental right to have counsel at the initial bond hearing.
Our court said they did.
And they did it under state constitutional law, so we couldn't appeal it to the Supreme Court of the United States.
But they
recently did, and our job is to, I'm a constitutional officer, and I have to defend the legislature and the Department of Corrections are clients that want to contest this. I actually think our system should be completely overhauled. I've never understood. You know, I was an assistant United States attorney and prosecuting gangs, but all kinds of crimes under Eric Holder, and the system there worked. The one here with this idea of commissioners never made any sense to me at all. I do think that people, they don't have a right to it, but the Court of Appeals of Maryland says they do now, though they didn't really predicate it upon the United States Constitution. Because they know we'd go to the Supreme Court and get it overturned, because it doesn't mean that it's not an important thing to have, and I do think it is important to have. But I do think we ought to be in front of judges, and we should revamp the system to comply with the way we do it with other states, so nobody's constitutional rights are abridged. Because I think that the caller that might have been an email is exactly right. We have so many biases in our criminal justice system.
But why oppose the heart of the question was, why did you continue to oppose the lawyers at bail? And it seems that whether it was you or Governor Martin O'Malley or the President of the Senate, it was when our highest court said this is the decision, it was like all the people in politics said, we don't care about your decisions, we're ignoring your decision.
Well, they all knew the decision was wrongly decided, but that said,
it was decided by the highest court of man.
Right. I went to the Supreme Court of the United States and I argued myself in the United States versus Schatzer case. A case that the highest court in Maryland decided involving a sexual predator, and I won 9-0 to overturn it. We got the DNA case overturned. I mean, just because the Court of Appeals says one thing doesn't mean it's consistent with other states and interpretation of the Constitution. But that's not the issue here, because to your point, the Court of Appeals has decided it, so it's the law of the state. So then the question is, how do you implement that law that they've just decided? And we have an obligation to defend the state government and every component, every department in it. It's a constitutional obligation. And so that's what we do. I didn't take a view on it one way or the other. We just took a legal position. My view is actually consistent with the Court of Appeals decision, which is, I do think people should have access to counsel at bail hearings and bond hearings. I think for a lot of reasons. One, it makes sense. But two, it actually helps cases get solved and settled. I mean, what we had in the system that I'm talking about, which we had in the District of Columbia, the cases were called no paper. They weren't even charged. When the police came in and you looked at a real prosecutor looked at the evidence and saw the case and they saw that this wasn't going to end up being a case, they could get rid of it right there and then, so the person wouldn't have to spend money on a lawyer and it wouldn't clog the system. So there's a much better way to do it than this whole commissioner concept that we have in Maryland. It's never made any sense to me.
410-319-8888 number here. Let me go to John in Mount Airy. You're on the air.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, John.
My question was for the Attorney General.
Sure.
I was reading The Sun this morning, and I came across Ben Jealous's
article criticizing your remarks. I was just wondering if you had any response to that.
Well, I haven't seen that, but Ben Jealous is obviously supporting the lieutenant governor, so I haven't seen his comments. I'm sure he's suggesting that what he said before is when I say that the lieutenant governor has been ineffective in terms of helping the people of Maryland, helping the people of Baltimore over the course of time, and has not managed people and run anything except for the Affordable Care Act, which is an unmitigated disaster, that somehow that's inappropriate. And I just don't think that's true, and I don't think people believe that's true.
So you came out – I do want to talk about this. You came out – your latest position you came out with in the press had to do with – high-speed rail in the state of Maryland. Just very quickly, I do want to touch on that before we go back to the phones. It's always been something we've talked about in the show for the last 21 years. I mean, the need for something like that in the state of Maryland to catch up with the rest of the world. But the federal government has stopped paying for these things. They're not paying for high-speed rail anymore. So how would you even implement that?
Well, I think it's probably one of the most important things that we can do for the city of Baltimore is actually to put in high-speed rail from Baltimore to Washington, because as I mentioned earlier, we have the most congested streets in the country here in this area, and it'll actually help in the D.C. area, the Prince George's area, and obviously in Baltimore, because it'll be cool. You know, people say we don't want to be relying on the federal government. The fact of the matter is we are, and so there are people that can work in the federal government in D.C. or even up here and go back and forth.
But how would we pay for it?
Well, it depends. There's different standards. You have to look at the maglev is obviously the gold standard, and we talk about that. Now, the Japanese want to pay for most of that. They want a footprint in the country, and they
still do, or they did once.
They still do, and they want it. But their ultimate goal, of course, is to go from Washington to Boston. But the first leg that they want to do is the Baltimore to Washington component, which is the only part I care about, is the future governor of Maryland. And so they want to pay a major portion of it. There's already the rail lines there. There's already the easements there. There's the federal government, I do think, would be willing to put in their share. The state would have to pay some money, but the Japanese want to do this so much they'll pay the most of it. But the state will have to pay some money to clear out some brush and that kind of thing and make the pathway easier. We could then utilize our port better. We could utilize our BWI better and bring people back into the city of Baltimore. That's the gold standard. Then you can look at something like the Acela, which runs every hour. You can have it rush hours run on 15-minute intervals and have a reduced rate for actual commuters, a significantly reduced rate. And so there's a lot of ways you could look at the high-speed rail concept, but I don't think we've been serious about it. We've talked about it, but we haven't been serious about it. I think it's time to get serious about it.
Thoughts on this, Jolene?
It's going to be a huge benefit to the city of Baltimore to have a huge influx of residents. We need people to buy up a lot of these houses. We have so much empty housing here in Baltimore, and it's really bringing down the whole economy. So by having a big influx of citizens here, people who can live here and buy things here and support the economy, I think it would be great.
410-319-8888 is the number here, and let's go back to the phones. Bruce, you're on the air, Southeast Baltimore.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, Bruce.
So, to be fair to Mr. Gangster, I'm an independent person that generally leans conservative, not on all issues, but on most issues. So, I'm 98% certain I'd probably vote for Republican Mr. Hogan. But one of the issues I'm really concerned with, I pay a lot of attention to, is development. And what I don't like is when development isn't practical and pragmatic and it isn't fair. So Mr. Gangster intervened on the State Center project downtown across the street from the 5th Regiment Army, and because of his intervention, tied it up in courts longer than it had to be and stalled the project when it was supposed to be it was supposed to be an open bid situation, and it wasn't. And Mr. Angelos was right in being concerned about it. And the only person that Peter Franchot, the controller, is the only Democrat that spoke up against it that had numbers, bean counter numbers, about the number of commercial properties were already vacant, could have been used, about the cost per square foot. I wish Mr. Peter Franchot would have ran for governor. I'd volunteer for him. I'd stand on my head for him.
Yeah, State Center, again, I sort of take a step back. A lot of people don't understand what the job of the Attorney General is. We are the lawyers for every state agency. We're the lawyers for the governor. We're the lawyers for the legislature, for the comptroller, Mr. Franchot, who's a good friend of mine, and for the treasurer and so forth. So we got involved in state senate because the governor, that was his position. I'm the lawyer for the governor. And that's where, so we took a legal position. I appreciate your noting how effective we were. In terms of, you know, Mr. Angelos, he's been a great citizen for the state of Maryland and for Baltimore. And you know, we totally respect what he has done for the city and his philanthropy and so forth. So, but I think the bigger point that you're making is development in Baltimore. And Jolene Ivey just made it. And, you know, Baltimore is a city that sort of, if you look at Baltimore and Detroit, they've been sort of left behind in this whole deal. You know, Philadelphia, D.C., right nearby are booming. Today, if you look in Baltimore, you'll probably have two cranes in the air. If you go to D.C., you'll have 53, 54, because the development is not happening in Baltimore City for a number of reasons, crime being one, schools being one, transportation being another. But we do need to really focus on the redevelopment of the city. And, you know, one of the things I did as Attorney General, as the head of all 50 attorneys general in the country and the president of that, and we reached an agreement with the five major banks, and we've gotten $1.5 billion into the state of Maryland to keep people in their homes away from being foreclosed upon that would otherwise been foreclosed upon because of the insidious conduct of the national bank. So we the housing market is important, and that's actually helped turn around the housing market somewhat, as well as the economy. So we need to really focus on smart growth, smart development in the city of Baltimore and elsewhere in Maryland.
410-319-8888. We have like 12 minutes left here. Let me go right to the phones. And Danielle in Annapolis, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Danielle. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Gamper, I've heard you describe yourself as both a conservative Democrat and a progressive. Which one are you?
I'm not sure I've ever called myself a conservative Democrat, but I think I'm fiscally conservative. I mean, I'm a fiscally conservative, socially progressive Democrat. I mean, I was by 6 years ahead of everybody else on marriage equality in the state, wrote an opinion recognizing out-of-state same-sex marriage. The Tea Party Republicans literally tried to impeach me, and my wife was hoping they'd be successful so I'd get a real job. I was the first statewide candidate to come out for increasing the minimum wage. I think it's the right thing to do. People making $7.25 an hour, 40 hours a week, are below the federal poverty line. That's just not fair. On the other hand, I think we need to have jobs back here. I think we really need somebody to make our tax policy competitive with our surrounding states, and that we need to have somebody that cares about jobs and keeping them here in Maryland and attracting new jobs to Maryland, particularly in the manufacturing sector, where we're now at the 43rd in the country and is killing the Eastern Shore in Western Maryland, as well as life sciences and cyber technology, which have an endless growth potential here in Maryland because of our natural advantages. And finally, in exports, you know, we have the Port of Baltimore. It's going to be one of the two deep water ports in the country on the East Coast that'll be able to export over to Europe and Asia, as well as BWI, which is underutilized. So I'm a fiscal conservative, but a social progressive.
How would you describe yourself, Jillian?
I know that I am extremely progressive on most things. I care very much about people. I have five beautiful boys, and I put a lot of my emphasis on education and on social welfare. I just know how much it's going to help single moms if we can do more to support them. They have a very tough job. I think single mothers actually have the toughest job in the entire world, even more than single dads. And my dad was a single dad for a number of years. My dad raised us on his own for a while when my mom left. But single moms, they're the ones who don't get the help that they need. A single dad at least will have the sympathy of our community who think that they're doing an extra job just because they're the single father. But single moms have a tough job, and we need to do more to help them. So I think that's one of my big concerns.
And if I could brag on Jolene for just 1 second, she started something called Mocha Moms, which is a national nonprofit with over 100 chapters nationally around that whole issue of single moms and mothers, women of color in terms of parenting issues. And that's one of her big issues.
And it's really very much focused on community service. Mocha Moms does a great job helping, giving back to the community. So Mocha Moms is a great organization. I'm really glad that I had such a strong hand in starting it 16 years ago. But it all just goes back to what my values are, and that's what the question was about.
On the way back to the phones, there's some environmental issues we have not covered.
Yesterday was Earth Day. You've been remiss.
We did Earth Day yesterday. We do Earth Day every day here on the Mark Steiner Show. But
speaking of Earth Day, Doug Gansler actually got one of the biggest penalties against an air polluter. And like history, $4.6 billion fine against an electric company for polluting our air. And it's one of the reasons I'm proud to be on his team.
The question I have has to do with the there was supposed to be the implementation of the scientific method to test phosphorus in the soil of farms. The governor could have implemented it. He didn't. State legislature backed away from it. Many people argue this is a disaster for the Bay. And some people have argued that it needs to be that the Poultry Fair Share Act was introduced, talking about putting a per tax head on chickens, but not the farmers paying for it, but Tyson Purdue paying for it. Other companies actually own the chickens. The state of the Bay is miserable. And I'm curious your stand on those two issues.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, and I've been I was the head of the environmental group for the National Attorneys General. I've been the environmental attorney general here in Maryland. It's been my biggest issue and our most passionate issue. And we've done an enormous amount of things in terms of environmental enforcement. And my big thing is converting chicken manure. You're talking about chicken into energy. We have about 1.5 billion pounds of chicken manure produced in Maryland each year. We have the ability to take 500 million pounds of it and convert it into 55 megawatts of power, which would be a great thing for the environment as well as an alternative source of energy. The first thing I had to do was get arsenic taken out of chicken feed, which we were able to do on a national level. It's called Roxazone, and we've got that out of there. And then I had to get chicken litter into energy, convert it as a tier one source so the utilities would have an economic incentive to buy it. And so that's a big issue in terms of the chicken side. In terms of the farmer issue with phosphorus, you know, we have a huge problem with agri-secrecy here, agricultural secrecy here. They hide it from us. And I actually went to the legislature years ago. There's something called nutrient management plans. And this every farmer in Maryland has to have a nutrient management plan. And they have to file a piece of paper in Annapolis that says they do.
Right.
And they wouldn't even allow us to have access to the piece of paper to see if they, in fact, had a nutrient management plan back at the farm. That was the level of agricultural secrecy that we have in Maryland because of the power of the pollution lobbyists in Annapolis. And they're all backing the lieutenant governor, and because they're afraid that I'm actually somebody that cares about the environment. And that's been my passion, and we're going to continue to work on that. Next week, we're going to have an announcement about a really breakthrough environmental. Actually, tomorrow it's going to be a breakthrough environmental situation.
Before you came on the show?
Oh, well, no, sorry about that, but it's good. You know, I'm happy to come back on and talk about it. It's you know, future. It's a George Jetson kind of future thing. You'll be happy about
it. All right, well, we'll talk about that next after you make the announcement. 410-319-8888. Let's try to get another call in here very quickly. Maggie, you're on the air.
Good morning. Peace and blessings to all of you.
Good morning, Maggie.
I have a question for your guest. I would like to know, do you think human rights or constitutional rights come first? Which do you think comes first, the human rights or the constitutional rights?
Well, I would like to believe that they're inextricably tied.
Not always.
But they're not. And that's why, you know, the Constitution is a living document. And we've had the longest Constitution in the industrialized world because of, I think, our flexibility and continuing to look at human rights and as they change. I mean, marriage equality is a great example of that. I mean, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the idea that same-sex couples be able to get married was certainly not seen as a human right and was absolutely not a constitutional right. It still isn't a constitutional right, but it's getting there. And so, and it is, you know, in some states. So I think it's in flux. I'd like to think that somebody like me who's been in public service now for 22 years, seeing problems, seeing things that aren't fair. That would be, for example, a denial of a human right, trying to fight as hard as I can to get it done and get it fixed. And I like to believe that I've actually been able to do that as a lawyer, as the attorney general of the state, making sure that human rights comply with the Constitution is also essential. And I think we've done a very good job at that.
And one thing that we should also remember is that access to health care is a human right. And it's something that we're really fighting to make sure that people in the state of Maryland get access to. And that's what Doug's been doing.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I started the first civil rights division in Maryland, and there's a lot of things that come under to Maggie's call. There's a lot of things that do come under that we have to make sure we're vigilant in promoting our civil rights, which are also human rights, and our interpretation of the Constitution.
So we didn't get a chance to get to all these questions. There's many more to ask you. We look forward to you two coming back in the next, how many weeks is it? 6 weeks?
I'm available tomorrow, but yeah, whenever you want.
All right. Well, no, we want you to come back to continue this conversation. There's many things we did not get to that we do want to get to, and I appreciate you both for taking the time.
Thanks, Mark. We appreciate you having us.
We're here with Attorney General Doug Gansler and the Delegate Jillian Ivey, who are running for governor, lieutenant governor, on the same ticket. Election is June the 24th.
Yeah.
Early voting starts June 12th.
That's an important point to make. Early voting is such. Some states are trying to kill that. At least we're not.
Well, we're going to do a different thing. We're going to have it be 1 week, but on the Saturday before the election, all the polls will be open. So it's like a real election day because people often don't vote on the Tuesday because of works. And a lot of people don't know where to go for early voting. So instead of 2 weeks, we're going to have it 1 week. But that Saturday, all the polls will be open, and then the following Tuesday will be election day.
Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mark. It was great.
We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, it's time for the history of rock and roll and all the controversy surrounding that. And tomorrow, by the way, folks, we're going to be tackling the Michigan case before the Supreme Court and more, and what the Supreme Court is saying about both race and corporate power in America. Stay with us for Rock and Roll, though, next hour.